It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Spring is coming, bringing birds back to Alaska. And perhaps the most delightful and amazing of those returning is the hummingbird. These tiny birds with wings that beat faster than the eye can see cover many thousands of miles, migrating from Florida and Mexico to coastal Alaska, from Ketchikan to Prince William Sound, and occasionally Anchorage too. They're hardy and at the same time, astonishingly light and delicate. On today's show, we'll be learning about hummingbirds in Alaska. And in putting it together, I was fascinated and surprised by the science on them. We'll also check in on a hummingbird festival that invites Alaskans to explore the early spring of our southeast. And we'll learn about backyard birding and conservation of small birds in the city. Please stay tuned for Hummingbirds on Outdoor Explorer. Well, my first guest today is probably the region's top hummingbird expert, a biologist who has been many years in Prince William Sound in Chattanooga and now in Cordova. Kate McLaughlin is someone that I have met in various different walks of life, and she is the person behind the Alaska Hummingbird Project, which is a nonprofit, which is a continuing study of hummingbirds in Alaska. Thanks for being with us, Kate.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So there are many, many species of hummingbirds, but Alaska is really the top end of their range, and not all of the species come here. So if you see a hummingbird in Alaska, it's liable to be one or two species, right? And what are the species that we see in Alaska?
That's correct. Of the approximately 338 known species of hummingbirds in the New World, only about 14 species come into the United States. Of those 14 species, only two occur in Alaska. The Anna's hummingbird is common in southeastern Alaska, but has been expanding its range up into south central. But our common breeder here that everybody is waiting to see come May is the little Rufous hummingbird. And it's the farthest northern breeding hummingbird in the world.
And it's kind of amazing that these tiny, tiny birds can get here and can survive in Alaska, where it seems like a fairly, we think of it as a harsh environment. And the pleasure of seeing them arrive is so great. And I just recall being in Chattanooga Bay, which is a village in Prince William Sound, and people being in the street and saying, the hummingbirds are here, and having them show up. And it's just, there's something about a hummingbird, isn't there?
There certainly is. They, along with the robins, are the real harbinger of spring in the Sound. They are very cold tolerant and so can handle, dips of below freezing temperature throughout the spring and summer. As a matter of fact, when they come up at the end of April, the beginning of May, we quite often still have snow on the ground and can have some nasty spring storms. They seem to be able to deal with these little breaks quite well.
It's so interesting when the way they can hover in the air with the incredibly rapid beat of their wing, and it makes me think they must be using a tremendous amount of energy, and maybe that's why they can withstand colder temperatures. How much energy do they take on board in terms of compared to other animals?
They do expend quite a bit of energy. A lot of people don't realize that hummingbirds don't exist solely on nectar from flowers, so they do get a significant amount of energy from those flowers. One of the reasons they can survive up here, especially in the early spring, is because they are members of the trochilid family, which means that they're insect eaters. They're members of the flycatcher family. Hmm. So that they will eat gnats and flies and small spiders and things of that nature. And that offers a huge protein boost, not only for them, for the energy that they need to expend in their on their daily excursions, but also for the young that they're raising.
Yeah. Well, where are they coming from when they show up here in May?
Well, that is one of the things that the Alaska Hummingbird Project is trying to determine. Our traditional historical knowledge of Rufous hummingbird life history is that these birds are wintering in Mexico, Southern California, southwestern United States. However, in the past 20 years or so, we, meaning the bunch of U.S. certified hummingbird banders throughout the United States and Canada, have started documenting rufous hummingbirds overwintering in the southeastern United States, Florida, Alabama, in those areas. This is really interesting for us. As a matter of fact, the first long-distance recovery I had of a bird that was banded outside of Alaska that I caught in Chinigaga was the long-distance recovery record for any hummingbird of any species, and it showed this link to the southeast United States. This bird was banded in Tallahassee, Florida in January of 2010, and then I caught her that subsequent summer in June in 2011 in Chinigaga Bay.
That's mind-boggling, Skate. I really have to say, I mean, this little bird, it's like almost, I mean, it could fit in the palm of your hand, across exactly. The entire continental United States in a matter of a few months, and also had to be so well-timed with the environment, right? Because it's looking for flowers, and it's looking for some very time-dependent kind of habitat that it has.
Exactly. They follow the bloom. The blueberry bloom is very important to them, the salmonberry blueberry bloom. And when we have late snowfalls that can depress the berry bloom, that will also depress the number and the timing of the birds that arrive into the sound. So I've seen shifts of their late April, May arrival and their subsequent beginning of August leaving from South Central Alaska. It's very, very dependent on the snow load. When we had snow apocalypse that year, completely depressed the berry bushes, and we had very poor breeding in South Central, and the birds arrived like 2 to 3 weeks late. And then on our early spring that we had last year, the birds arrived 2 weeks early, and then they subsequently left 2 weeks early. But that journey from Florida, that's 3,500 miles in a straight line, but we really don't think that it's flying in a straight line. So the question is not only where are they going in the winter, but how are they going? What is the path that they're taking?
Yeah, exactly. And that's still a mystery, it sounds like.
Yes. That's the fun thing about research like this. You get one little tiny question you think that you might be able to answer, and it opens up a whole book of many, many more questions that you hope to be able to start answering.
Well, here's one that you may not know the answer to then, about these rufous and Anna's hummingbirds. What is their northernmost range extension, and what is the probability of someone seeing them in, say, Anchorage?
They do occasionally spill over into Cook Inlet and the Anchorage Bowl. I occasionally get reports of them even up into the Mat-Su Valley. Rufuses are known in particular as wanderers. They tend to just scatter and find new territories. It's probably one of the reasons why this species is so successful, even though it is currently a species of international concern, mostly due to habitat destruction. Sure. And forces of that nature. But as a species of hummingbird, they are very adaptable. They're very tough. And they can show up at strange places at strange times. And especially now that we are getting a lot of influences from global climate change, we are really starting to see birds showing up in very strange places at strange times. Had a rufous in Ohio in January.
Wow.
Birds show up, and we're not quite sure. Are they lost, or do they have an intention? They're not telling us.
Right. Are they kind of wherever these blueberry blossoms might be found? Is that one of the determinants of where they would go?
They are. Rufuses are throughout the Pacific Northwest. You can find them in Sedona, Arizona, out in the desert. You can find them in the mountains of British Columbia. If they have flowers to exploit, and they will certainly do so. But here in South Central, the main species of plants that they're very dependent on are the berry bushes. But they will also feed on columbine and geranium and monkey flower and a host of other common Alaska wildflowers, as well as eating all those wonderful gnats and mosquitoes that we're usually so blessed with in our wet summers.
Yeah, well, we thank them for that, for sure. So are they pollinators for our berries? I mean, are they performing that role as well?
They are very important pollinators, and we still don't really know the extent of that importance. But every summer, I'm catching birds and putting bands on them, and they're all liberally dusted with gold and green pollen from all the berry bushes and flowers that they're visiting. So you can tell just by observing what a great job they do keeping our berries blooming.
How glorious. It's a wonderful, wonderful little creature, and we obviously owe it a lot. We're talking about hummingbirds today, and my guest right now is Kate McLaughlin. She's coming to us from Cordova, where she is the head of the Alaska Hummingbird Project. She's been studying hummingbirds in Prince William Sound for about 10 years now, and probably, or perhaps assuredly, knows more about hummingbirds in our region than anyone else. And I'm just really eating it up. It's such a fascinating topic. Thanks so much for being with us, Kate. So when you are catching and studying these birds, are you attracting them with a feeder that has some kind of sweetened water to attract them to a particular location?
The success of my banding stations all depends on annually maintained feeders. The more feeders that are kept up throughout the season, every season, the better host of birds that you will have. So I cultivate relationships. I like to meet gardeners who love hummingbirds and who love to keep their hummingbird feeders up, so I can come over to their house, place a little trap around that feeder, and then start handing out little shiny bits of bling for the birds. And the homeowners are usually, at first they may be a little concerned that I might scare away or, God forbid, harm the birds. But after I've gone through the protocols and ensure the homeowner that, no, in fact, I will not scare away the bird, and that the health and safety of the bird is the utmost priority for us. So the birds are usually in our hand no less than less than 3 minutes from capture time through all the data processing and to release.
That sounds just terrifying to me, because this is such a tiny bird and it's so delicate, right? And
they are such a contradiction of terms. They are incredibly hardy and tough, yet they are incredibly delicate, tiny little birds. The average weight of a rufous hummingbird is around 4.8 grams. That's about the weight of three large paperclips.
Wow.
They have the largest heart size, brain size, lung size of any other bird species, because they're just working so much on the edge. They're just little powerhouses of energy. But
that ability to fly with a rapid wing motion and hover, I guess, is partly a product of being extremely light and having no excess weight on board.
That's part of it. They also have very unique morphology in the way their wing structure is made, so that their joints in their wings are work kind of like a U-joint in a car. It can. They have a figure-eight motion. They're able to move their wings forwards and backwards, and also rotate the wing at the shoulder and at the elbow joint, so to speak, if you're thinking comparatively to a human arm. This allows them to not only hover, but to move upside down and backwards all at once. Through studying bumblebee flight and hummingbird flight, scientists were able to do drone technology. So it was through learning flight capabilities of hummingbirds, we've been able to extend our own knowledge of flight capabilities.
Yeah, although probably not come anywhere close to matching the ability of these birds. And
not at all.
Yeah, and they need that because they're... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, here's an interesting factoid for you. Male hummingbirds do a display flight in the spring, both for territorial awareness and also to show off for the females. Different species have different trajectories. The rufous does a J dive. He'll find a nice sunny perch up on top of a tree or exposed branch. The sun is hitting him. And when he thinks he's got an audience, he'll fly up into the air, issue his little war cry, and then dive straight down to the ground. And then about 10 feet from the ground, he'll pull up in a J motion. At the end of that dive, you'll hear a sound coming that's actually issuing, a trilling sound that's issuing from his wingtips. At the point of that dive where the wingtips are trilling, he's actually pulling more G's than a jet fighter pilot could endure.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, and hitting speeds at like over 200 some odd miles per hour. I don't remember the exact speed that they've been clocked at, but we put a jet pilot through that, and he's a goner.
Yeah, incredible, amazing. So you have a wonderful job of studying these magnificent birds in one of the most beautiful places on Earth through the Hummingbird Project. But can't be easy to get funding and to keep your project going. Tell us about your organization.
Yeah, I started the 501c3 approximately 2 years ago in order to be able to take tax-deductible donations and also solicit grant funds from other organizations that might be interested in this research. The project basically is funded pretty much out of my own pocket up until that point. We're always looking for funding for sugar. As you can imagine, I go through quite a bit of sugar every year. Hummingbird feeders, trapping equipment, and also travel money for me to be able to get out to my remote banding sites in Prince William Sound, and also to be able to travel to those incidences when we get a rare occurrence of a hummingbird in the state. That I might be able to get over and document that bird. For example, not this winter, but the winter past, we had a Costa's hummingbird in Anchorage that was photo documented by the Anchorage Audubon Society. That was an extremely unusual bird. He definitely was, I think, was lost. He took a left when he should have taken a right at Albuquerque.
Right.
So he ended up in Anchorage, I think that was around October of last year. And he had some pretty pictures taken of him in the newspaper and in the birding forums.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't able to get over there to actually try to catch and band him, but these types of incidences we are documenting. And
there's somebody here who's doing this kind of work, and that's great. And we'll make sure that your link is on our webpage at outdoorexplorer.org if folks want to learn more about hummingbirds and how to get in touch with Kate McLaughlin and the Alaska Hummingbird Project and support her work or learn more about what she's doing. And she's also got quite a few great hummingbird videos there, some of which are really truly unique in terms of the hummingbirds that she's found in Alaska that have never been filmed here before. So Kate, I would say we were talking a little bit about climate change and how that has moved the range of hummingbirds northward, and I guess that's good to look for silver linings in everything. But it sounds like there's also some threats to hummingbirds, including the species that we see here. Tell us about those.
A lot of the threats to hummingbirds happen to be habitat destruction on their wintering grounds. One of the speculations as to why rufuses might be establishing more of a wintering population in the southeastern United States has been that perhaps between the habitat destruction and the drought and the fires that is happening in Mexico and southwestern United States, along with the warmer temperatures occurring in the southeastern United States throughout the winter, these birds are just simply choosing to stay. Why travel across the Gulf of Mexico, potentially hazardous flight, and you may not have a wintering habitat there when you could stay in a nice Atlanta Buckhead garden all winter long and do just fine. Here in Alaska, our threats are more indirect. We do have habitat destruction, but not, of course, to the extent that this was happening in the southern parts of the nation. But more, how does climate change affect the timing and the availability for the birds to get the resources they need and successfully breed? That's one. Regime shifts of habitat that can change the quality and the quantity of the food resources that they're having.
And so just to sort of explicate that a little bit, so if you're a hummingbird and you're expecting to show up and the flowers are going to be blooming in a sequence that it's going to get you where you need to be, and that timing and sequence has changed, you might not make it. I mean, you might end up somewhere else, or you might not get the resources that you need to breed.
Right, or you might not be able to be successful to fledge those young. All animals live on a knife edge. Even the smallest disturbance could be the straw that breaks the camel's back as far as their own survivability or their young survivability. In Alaska, it's even more on the extreme. The males arrive here, the rufous hummingbird males arrive in Alaska right about the end of April, beginning of May, depending on the snow load. The females arrive a week to 2 weeks behind them. They have barely 3 months to get territory, find mates, raise the babies, and leave. The males do not help at the nest once they've got their ladies, that they're happy, and they start leaving Alaska by July. The females and the immature of the year will stay for another month, and then they leave Alaska, or at least South Central Alaska, by end of July, beginning of August. So if you think about how a big snow event like snow apocalypse could really jeopardize, put everything back 3 weeks, they just might not have enough time to successfully do that.
Yeah, yeah. And as the climate changes and those kinds of events and extreme events change, then that's another threat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we have, it's interesting to see how what might shape up with the Anna's hummingbirds now coming into South Central, how will those two species overlap and interact with each other? It's interesting because we're not seeing the Anna's during the summer on the feeders, just the rufuses, but after the rufuses leave, then we're starting to see the Anna's in the fall.
Huh.
We think the majority of the Anna's are moving out and migrating as they are wont to do down to Mexico. However, I think more and more we're getting a few that are deciding to stay. So this fall, I made the first banding documentation of Anna's hummingbirds in South Central Alaska. We had had personal observations and photo documentation, Audubon Christmas counts, of the one or two Anna's showing up throughout the fall and winter throughout South Central, in Kenai, Homer, Cordova, Seward. But we had never had an actual in-the-hand banding the bird. So this October, I was able to catch an immature male and an adult female here in Cordova, place some bands on their legs, and set them free. I've been watching them all winter, saw them yesterday, as a matter of fact, so they've been surviving these storms. Pretty amazing.
Is that normal? Yeah. I mean, for them to hang around all winter, it's got to be, I mean, I would think that would be a very unusual occurrence.
Absolutely. Hummingbirds are capable of short periods of hibernation called topor. So when the weather gets really bad and it's not good to fly around, too cold, they'll just go find themselves a sheltered spot up in the trees and basically hibernate for a couple of days or until it warms up enough. You know, if it's warm enough for the insects to fly, they'll fly too. And as you know, as an Alaskan, you can see bugs flying around even though it might be snow on the ground. So they definitely take advantage of that insect source.
Wow, what a story of survival! Hummingbirds making it through an Alaska winter, and that puts our Iditarod mushers to shame.
The other interesting thing about this banding occurrence is the fact that I caught an immature male in the fall. All the past documentation sightings of Anna's that we had had in South Central have been either females, for the most part, have been females, or immature males in the early fall. Unless the bird is in your hand, it's almost impossible to determine if it's an immature bird or if it's a female, just by physical observation. You really have to look at it closely and take some measurements and certain morphological characteristics to determine exactly what you have in your hand. But we never were able to really say, are these birds breeding here in South Central, or are these just fall strays, stragglers going the wrong way, just decided to come up here and stay? But with the with this immature male, and then there was a photo documentation of a male, an adult male, in Seward last spring, we're pretty sure that we've got a burgeoning breeding population of Anna's in South Central.
Interesting, and maybe a new thing because of a warming climate. although we don't really know what was there before, but obviously it's right. It's suggestive. Yeah.
That's what's so cool about annas, because annas were a species up until the 1940s was limited to Baja California. That was as far as north as they went.
Wow, that's incredible.
By the 70s, they were spreading up through Northern California and starting to go into Idaho. Now, by the 90s, they were in British Columbia, and now here they are in the 2000s, already into South Central Alaska. So, just an amazing species.
Yeah. Good for you, little birds.
Yeah, we need to know lots more about them.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Kate. And we're going to talk much more about hummingbirds during this hour, including for bird watchers, where you can see them, and we have a hummingbird festival here in Alaska, and how to set up a feeder. This has been a fascinating introduction to these amazing birds. And if folks want to know more about Kate McLaughlin's organization, you can find it through our website at outdoorexplorer.org. It's called the Alaska Hummingbird Project Incorporated. Kate McLaughlin joining us from Cordova. Thanks so much for being on Outdoor Explorer with us.
Thank you, Charles. And let me put in one more plug, if I could.
Go right ahead.
In May, the beginning of May, we have here in Cordova the Copper River Shorebird Festival. And the hummingbirds hopefully will be here in May, and I will be presenting at the Shorebird Festival on the project.
Fantastic. And Cordova is such a fun place to visit and very easy to get to from Anchorage if you haven't done it. It's not far away, and it's a terrific weekend getaway at the end of the winter and the beginning of spring. All right. Well, stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking today about hummingbirds, and I didn't want to do this topic without at least once hearing a hummingbird. Fortunately, we don't have to because we have BirdNote, and BirdNote contributor Alex Chadwick visited the outskirts of Big Bend National Park in Texas to meet with retired park manager and biologist Kelly Bryant. Kelly spends his days placing bands on hummingbirds to better know their habits.
I'm watching Kelly work with the birds, tiny, colorful, delicate, held carefully in his blunt, working hands. He's banded more than 14,000 hummingbirds, he says, and never injured one. He's about to release this one.
I'm going to hold it up to your ear. Sounds like a little motor in overdrive, doesn't it?
The bands are very small, uniquely numbered strips of aluminum, and one goes around one small bird leg above the foot.
Human's heart beats about 70, 80 beats a minute. Even at rest, the hummingbird's heart is beating 700 to 800 beats a minute. And this little bird's probably at about 1,200 beats a minute.
A hummingbird that Kelly banded 3 years ago in Texas was caught and identified by another ornithologist in Alaska 2 years ago. And then she re-caught the same bird last year. That's their migration, Alaska to Mexico. Kelly studies hummingbirds by banding legs and keeping data on each one. He's normally at it 5 days a week. Today on a friend's land, surrounded by a grove of trees, and hummingbird feeders carefully placed in open-door bird cages. At the click of a remote, the cage doors close, and the feeding birds inside can be placed in small mesh bags and then taken out.
Okay, here comes the first bird. I'll reach into this bag, and the thing about hummingbirds is you've got to maintain control over them.
It can be unnerving to see a captured hummingbird, vulnerable and wide-eyed. Kelly has his fingers over the shoulders to stop the wings beating. He slips a tiny numbered band on a leg, measures length of feathers and the bill, and then weighs the bird.
You can put about 8 of these birds in an envelope and mail them.
8 to an ounce. I called hummingbirds delicate, but they are triathletes of the bird world. Barely a tenth of an ounce, and they migrate from Alaska to Mexico and back and stop to hunt and feed, insects importantly, all along the way. There's a pleasing simplicity to banding. It's almost pre-industrial science. Careful observation, meticulous data collection, repeat, repeat, repeat.
Hummingbirds are kind of changing their patterns, especially all these western species that are migrating to the central Gulf Coast of the United States to spend the winter.
These birders share their data, and from it, they make a data mosaic of the natural world, and it's a big pattern.
I don't know if you know it or not. You know, John James Audubon was the first person to band a bird in the United States. at his farm in Pennsylvania, he saw these eastern phoebes coming back to this cave and nesting in the same ledge every year. And so one time he put a wire around the leg of the phoebe. And, of course, those eastern phoebes migrate. They leave for the winter. And guess what? The next spring, a phoebe came back, started building a nest on that ledge in that cave, and he caught that phoebe and looked at its leg, and it had that wire around its leg. So he recognized back in the 1850s the importance of having a bird tagged in some way.
Audubon, the founder of American ornithology, naturalist, artist, bird bander, in a line that now also counts Kelly Bryan in Southwest Texas, ready to release his latest subject.
He's done, and he goes bye-bye.
For Bird Note, this is Alex Chadwick in Big Bend National Park. Funding for the Bird Note series on Big Bend National Park comes from Dee Dee and Rusty Rose.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and our topic today is hummingbirds. They show up every year in April in southeast Alaska and then make their way up northward, as we heard earlier, into south central Alaska in late April or May. And there is a festival celebrating their arrival at the very southern tip of our state in Ketchikan. And that's what we're going to talk about for a few minutes now. Leslie Swada is with us. She is the director of the Southeast Alaska Discovery Center, which is the, sounds like the HQ for the Alaska Hummingbird Festival. The Discovery Center is part of Tongass National Forest. Thanks for being with us, Leslie.
Thanks very much for having me.
So it's kind of exciting when the hummingbirds show up and you start seeing them in the springtime. You really know spring is there.
Absolutely, and we sometimes see them mid-March, if you can believe it. So it's pretty amazing that they travel all the way from the southern tip of Mexico and arrive here basically in March, early April. And so for over 20 years, we've been celebrating the Alaska Hummingbird Festival. And we've been doing so with our mascot, who's the Rufus Hummingbird. And it's a petite, and we call him the petite pennyweight flyer because he does travel 4,000 miles to breed here in Alaska and then returns to Mexico for the winter.
It's amazing that these tiny little birds can do this. And as our previous guest said, they weigh about as much as a small handful of paper clips, and yet they, you know, withstand this incredible migration and also Alaskan conditions. So what is it, I mean, when you're in Ketchikan and the hummingbirds are arriving in March and April, how common are they? I mean, is it a challenge to find them, or do you run into them fairly commonly?
You can start seeing them, especially if you have a feeder in your yard. You can definitely see them. I think they choose feeders, you know, they have their preference or something, and they come back and return to the ones they like. So we do see them, not, you know, like every day or something like that. You kind of need to be in the right place at the right time and looking the right direction to see them. But absolutely, they are here, and we definitely celebrate them. And like I said, the hummingbird is the festival mascot because of the long journey that they take. But the festival also celebrates the return of all migratory birds. So it's just that this one happens to be, you know, our mascot.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. It's a reminder of how vast Alaska is, that the climate in Ketchikan is really completely different from the climate here in Anchorage. And your winters are very mild, much more like the Pacific Northwest. And so spring comes, you know, a month or 6 weeks earlier there. And so if somebody wants to sort of do a fun within Alaska trip, going down to Ketchikan in April, it actually kind of makes sense to participate in this festival.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that the festival was originally created, was because local visitor folks here in town were wanting to extend the visitor season, because currently it begins in May. And so the thought was, well, maybe we could have a festival in April and entice visitors and birders to Ketchikan to experience the Tongass National Forest, as well as to see the hummingbirds in all their glory.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you do for the festival? Give us sort of a sense of the rundown. And we'll also, I'm sure you have a website. We'll make sure that's posted on outdoorexplorer.org as well.
So the festival kicks off with the Alaska Hummingbird Festival Juried Art Show, which is an art show for Alaskan artists. And Alaskan artists are invited to depict the migratory birds of Southeast Alaska. And, they send in their works, and we hang the show here. And the show stays up for 2 months so that the visitors, when the visitors do come in May, can see it. And that actually kicks off the whole festival. And that art opening is Friday, April 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. And then the next day, we quickly go right into our birding hikes. So basically, we do the art show, then we do the birding hikes on Saturday, and then oftentimes we'll also have activities for youth and their families so that they can create and learn about bird adaptations or migration to Alaska.
Do you actually have snow-free trails there in April?
What's that?
Do you actually have the trails are free of snow by April in your part of the state?
Yeah, we have very little snow. I mean, usually the rain comes straight away. I mean, even now there's snow on the ground here, but the rain has come, so the roads are clear.
Yeah, wow. It kind of takes it's a big adjustment from thinking about our region of the state. So everything gets started so much earlier, and so it's this opportunity for folks to go birding. What are the main components of the migration that you see? Obviously, the rufous hummingbirds. What other birdwatching is hot in April? Do you get the shorebirds or migratory waterfowl? Or what are your main things you're looking at?
Yeah, so, obviously some of the first birds that you'll hear and see are the robins, the American robin. And then we'll also see the varied thrush and... we do a hike on Gravina Island, which is an island that our airport is located on, if you can believe it. So we take a ferry over there, and we hike along the shoreline to see some of the shorebirds. And the main part of that is that we get to see just tens of thousands of geese flying overhead as they head north. And that is just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And the Discovery Center itself as well, we're seeing, just to familiarize folks with what the Discovery Center is, it's more than a visitor center. It's also kind of a whole museum.
Yeah, it is a museum. So we have four exhibit rooms, and the first one highlights the temperate rainforest. And so, I just spoke about the varied thrush and the American robin. Those guys are both in the exhibit, and the varied thrush is singing its heart out. So, we definitely get a lot of visitors asking, what is that bird? My goodness. And it's so fun to tell them that, hey, when this bird sings, locals here in Ketchikan realize that spring is here, because it just really lets us know. And if you don't know that sound, it sounds like a train whistle. So it's just really gorgeous.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what else is there in the center?
So we also have our Native Traditions exhibit rooms, which highlights the Native traditions of Southeast Alaska, and was designed by 10 Native elders who were chosen by their own Native people from the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian. And then we have Ecosystems Room, which shows all the ecosystems and just how the interaction between the different species and their environment works together. And then finally, we have the Resources Room, which talks about the point of contact forward, so about 300 years ago to the present day. And so that focuses more on the natural resources of Southeast Alaska and how they're utilized to sustain people.
Okay, great. Well, there you have it, folks. I mean, Ketchikan in April, the Hummingbird Festival. Sounds like well worth it for bird watchers, and if you want to get an early jump on spring. And thanks very much, Leslie Swada, director of the Southeast Alaska Discovery Center, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we are talking about hummingbirds, a fascinating little animal. You can fit, you can put like eight of them in an envelope and mail them with a first-class stamp. That's how little they weigh. And yet they can fly all the way across the North American continent. And it's springtime, so it's time for hummingbirds to arrive. And so I wanted to, in this segment of the show, talk about your chances of seeing a hummingbird in Anchorage, how you could improve those chances, where you could go to look for one. And then also just the general topic of backyard birdwatching and birdwatching in the Anchorage Bowl. And for that topic, we have our birdwatching go-to guy, Mr. Whitekeys. And Mr. Whitekeys is better known perhaps for his entertainment that he puts on, the Whale Fat Follies and Christmas in Spinard that take place, the Cabaret Review dog poop joke emporium. He's also one of our leading bird watchers in Anchorage and president of the local Audubon?
Commander-in-Chief.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Grand Poobah. Right. So you've seen hummingbirds right here in the Anchorage Bowl, right?
Oh, yeah. Hummingbirds are a little bit scarce in Anchorage. The main hummingbird that we have here, the Rufous hummingbird, is a coastal rainforest bird. So you go to Cordova, you'll see them. There's a feeder at the FAA building at the Cordova Airport. There are always just all kinds of hummingbirds there. You can see them. Then they come to Seward. And so part of the coastal rainforest is Portage. And
it's that little pocket.
There. Yeah, and there's one place that you can see them in Portage very regularly. There's a little cafe that's sort of across the giant parking lot from the Biggitchbaugh's Visitor Center.
Uh-huh.
And the tour buses go in there for lunch, and they have this little dining room with a solarium. And outside that solarium in the woods, in the back of that, they have a couple hummingbird feeders.
Well, I'll be darned.
And if you're there in usually June and July are the hot times because they leave fairly early. But you can usually see them right there. And that in the Anchorage municipality is the go-to spot.
And this brings up the point that the hummingbirds go to these feeders. And once they've learned that there's a feeder there, they'll keep coming back to it for years, right?
Oh, absolutely. They can. And they also can be seen in Girdwood, but there used to be a couple of cafes in Girdwood that had hummingbird feeders, and they were pretty regular there. But I haven't seen those feeders up in years. And there's usually giant flower pots in front of the bake shop at Girdwood and also right in front of the hotel. And they do frequent those places, but you have to wait a little longer.
So if the Chair 5 restaurant wants to sell more Alaskan Amber, they should put up a hummingbird feeder.
And everybody would be going there.
Yeah.
And then, one other thing. See, the northernmost boundary of the Sitka spruce coastal rainforest is technically on the south side of Bird Creek.
Huh.
So the Sitka spruce come in there, and this last summer, I know a lady at Bird Creek that had hummingbirds there all summer.
Wow.
So they might be expanding their range. In Anchorage, they're pretty sparse. I've seen three here in 40 years.
And you really look.
They just have to show up. But
right.
But last year, one was seen with some people right about the 1st of June at Potter Marsh.
Wow.
On the old Seward Highway behind Potter Marsh, and somebody saw it flit across the road, and nobody ever saw it again. But
been wandering and come up from Bird Creek.
Well, it could have been, and it could have been hanging out there. I mean, again, you've just got to be in the right place at the right time to see these birds. And
yeah.
Then they have been seen in Palmer. They've been seen up at the Sheep Mountain Lodge. They've been seen in Tulkeetna, but those are really sparse sightings. And unfortunately, I've never had a Rufous hummingbird come to my house for a hummingbird feeder, but I've had them show up three times over the decades just in the flowers.
Mm.
So I've never succeeded in that. But then you have the stray hummingbirds, and in the fall...
So that we're talking about Rufous.
Those
so
are Rufous hummingbirds, but Anna's hummingbirds come to Anchorage and come to this area. But the rule is if you see a hummingbird after the 1st of October or late into September, it's going to be an Anna's. And they get lost completely, and they wind up, but they do winter. There were two that wintered in Seward this year, and Kate had some wintering in Cordova, and they winter in Ketchikan. And
so we're talking about like individual birds.
Or a pair. There were a pair in Seward, and I think there was a pair in Cordova, and there were a couple in Homer.
That's such a hardy little bird. I mean,
they're tough.
The heck do they do
These
that?
Guys are tough. And I had an Anna's a year ago in the end of September, beginning of October, that came to my house. There's another birder, Theed, that lives a few houses away, and he's one of the most amazing birders in Alaska, and he has had an Anna's come to his house briefly in that period of time around the 1st of October for several years.
And so, this is in Turnagain.
Yeah. So that year and a half ago, he called me one day. He said, I just had an Anna's, but my feeder was empty. It came and looked at the feeder, and it took off. And I said, look. And man, we were running around the block looking at every flower on the block, and I put up a feeder. And 2 days later, this Anna's settled in about 3 days. And so then it took off, and that was about the 1st of October. Well, then, late in October, the very end of October, we go outside to visit my mother in Phoenix, and we come back on a Thursday night, and just before Halloween, and it's dark. We get in at 10 o'clock at night. It's pitch dark. We wake up the next morning, and there's snow on the ground. There's 2 or 3 inches of snow. And, you know, I mean, every good birding story starts with domestic strife. You know? So the hummingbird feeder was still up. And you know, my girlfriend looks at the snow and says, all right, I want you to get out there today and get that big metal post out of the ground because it's going to freeze in there all winter. We're going to have to look at it. I grumbled a lot. And, you know, it was before the sunrise. And so we're wandering around the house, and about 2 hours later, I hear this shriek. It's like, there's a hummingbird at the feeder! And this is like October 29th or something.
In the snow.
And I ran out and saw it, and then it perched in this bush next to the feeder, and I grabbed the camera and took a photo, and I said, cow, this looks sort of weird. And we'd just been in Phoenix, and there were a lot of hummingbirds there, and it was just because of that I said, that's a Costa's. And there have been like 6 Costa's in Anchorage or the surrounding area ever. This was just incredible. And it stayed for 2.5 weeks.
So is it way outside its range?
It's totally. These Costa's are birds of the desert southwest. I mean, they're Phoenix birds. And their range, the range map in the bird books doesn't show them getting much past the middle of Nevada.
Wow.
But they do get up to Seattle, up to the Washington, the Canadian border, occasionally. And this one, you know, was like the 6th or 7th one in Alaska ever, and, you know, it was totally out of range. And, again, it was just regular. It stayed there for 2.5 weeks, and then it started getting really cold, and we had this elaborate system of, you know, bathroom heat lamps, running, you know, 500 watts of lamps to keep the food from freezing. And then we built a little nest out of spruce and birch twigs and stuff, and had a heat lamp on that. And, and then she disappeared one night. And, you know, we have no idea whether she took off or whether she didn't make it because it was pretty cold. But these guys can fly. You know, they could fly to Juneau in, you know, 14, 15 hours. I mean,
it's amazing, isn't it? It seems like they're so small. How could they have enough energy on board to do that?
Well, they need to bulk up hugely for a migration like that. And then when they get there, I mean, you know, because again, they weigh, you know, an ounce or a quarter of an ounce, you know, I mean, they're tiny. And so they bulk up for those migratory trips. But there was one guy, maybe there's two records. I mean, those are the only 3 hummingbirds in Alaska, and I've had all 3 in my yard. I'm the only person that's ever had.
That's why you're the grand poobah.
Well, just dumb luck, but it happened. But there's a guy, Bob Dittrich, that used to guide birding adventures, and he would take people up into Anwar. And up in Anwar, on a float trip one time, he saw a ruby-throated hummingbird, which is an East Coast bird com- completely. And that's there might be one other record of a ruby-throated in Alaska, but you know, so the Costas, they're, you know, 6, 7, 8 records, and you know, the Annas and Rufus are the ones that you see.
Yeah. Talk about hummingbirds with Mr. White Keys. That was a beautiful 10-minute monologue. I loved it. Outdoor Explorer. How do you build a hummingbird feeder if somebody wants to give it a try? Because it sounds like once you've built it, if you're, especially for our listeners down in the peninsula, and they find it, you might have hummingbirds coming back to it pretty regularly.
Oh, you might, and you don't. You buy them. I mean, you just go out and you can buy expensive ones. You can buy $10 ones. You know,
is it just sugar water?
Yeah. And you just it's a 3-to-1 mixture, and it's best not to use red food coloring. They don't need that. And sometimes if you know, the hummingbird feeders are always red with little, you know, yellow flowers on the feeding spouts, and But you can also hang, you know, like get a red ribbon and tie a big bow, or, you know, put some red sequins on it. I mean, anything that's red will attract them. And they, if they're around, they will find the feeder. I got a friend, Paul Fritz, who was one of the founders of the Gunsight Mountain Hawk Watch, and did that for years. And he used to tell the story about being on the East Coast in Pennsylvania and stuff with his brother, and they would go hunting. And whenever they went hunting or camping, his brother always carried a hummingbird feeder. And they would move into the campsite, and he'd hang it from a branch, and there would be hummingbirds there within 10 minutes. I mean, it was just like clockwork.
How cool.
There was a, last fall, at an Audubon Society meeting, there were two people, Anita and Burl Thorne. They have a boat in Prince William Sound, and they carry a hummingbird feeder with them. And they're out in Prince William Sound. They're anchored maybe 100 yards offshore in some little cove. They hang the hummingbird feeder for the boat, and these hummingbirds will go out and find the boat over the water.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean,
they must have an amazing sense of smell.
If they're around you, well, and it's that red color, too. I mean, they are totally keyed in on the red color. So if they're around and you have a hummingbird feeder, you're very likely to find them.
If you're in that coastal rainforest.
If you're in the habitat. Now, in Anchorage, there aren't many here. Now, there are some, but there aren't many of them, so your chances of success are a little bit, you know, less. But
you can always go to the cafe at the Portage
Glacier Cafe, and then you get them.
that's so fun. So the thing about them that I think is so appealing is that they're such an obvious bird, and there's the way they hover around, you can really get a good look at them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of all respect for bird watchers, but a lot of times, like, there's some little bird way off, and I'm sort of squinting at it, and everybody's excited, and then it flies away, and I think, what was I supposed to see? But these guys, you really get to see.
Well, you do get to see them if there's a feeder, and they'll come to the feeder, and they might only stay there for, you know, 20 seconds, and they're gone, but then they come back, and they come back and
forth. Because they can hover in place.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and they're tough little birds. I mean, you think of them as so small and delicate, but, you know, they can withstand the winters in Alaska. I mean, these guys, you know, there have been some around this part of the state this winter. They also, I saw one once in the desert in Arizona, just come down and out of nowhere and just nail a mockingbird, which is probably, you know, 100 times the size of the hummingbird, and just come down and just nail him right on the head and take off. You know, I mean, they'll take on anybody. They're not shy, retiring little guys.
So funny to think of their little tiny brain being able to do all that.
Yeah.
So let's talk more about other kinds of birds and backyard bird feeding in Anchorage. What kinds of tips do you have for somebody who wants to set up a bird feeder, and what kind of birds they can look at and times of year and that sort of thing?
Holy smokes. Well, there are birds everywhere in Anchorage. Right now, there is this giant invasion of red poles. I mean, I've got 200 to 300 in my yard every day. Uh-huh. And the sort of default feed for birds in your yard is sunflower seeds, and you can get the black sunflower seeds, the regular black cheap sunflower seeds, or you can get the cracked just white seeds that are the inside of the black sunflower seeds, and they're way more expensive, but they are way more popular with the birds. Uh-huh. Birds, you put out sunflower seeds in the shell and sunflower seeds not in the shell, they will ignore the ones in the shell. They're looking for the easy, free lunch.
And just throw them on the ground.
You throw them on the ground. You can get tube feeders. You can do a table feeder. There's a... I know guys that just put a whole sheet of plywood out and just sprinkle them on that. You know, I mean,
do you do this year round?
You can. You know, there's a lot of recommendations for bears if you're especially on the hillside not to take in your feeders in April. In late April. I don't, because my neighborhood has had a couple of bears over 30 years, but it's very unusual. I mean, they're just not there. And the other thing, get a little suet feeder, and again, they're $1.99 for the suet feeder, and you get these little blocks of suet.
Like down at Alaska Mill and Feed or something that.
Yeah, they're sort of the center of it, but there are feeders at other places too. So the sort of the tube feeders, a platform feeder of some kind, whether it's just something you made out of a piece of wood or you get a platform feeder, and the suet, and then the other thing is peanut butter.
Okay.
Now, you can spread peanut butter on anything. I know a guy that had a moose rack on a pole and would just spread peanut butter on the moose rack. The sort of standard is to take a birch log that's 4 or 5 inches in diameter and cut off about a foot or a foot and a half of it, and then just drill some big holes in it and pack them with peanut butter and hang it out there. And the nuthatches and the boreal chickadees love peanut butter, and so do the magpies. It's super high energy. The magpies will show up. They really like it when it's cold, and you've put the peanut butter in there, and it just almost freezes solid. And the magpies go with their big bill, and they go to that hole that's in the log that you put the peanut butter in, and they can pull the whole chunk out. It'll just come out of the hole, and the magpies love that.
I don't know how many magpies you want around, though.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah, magpies sort of, scare most everybody else away.
Yeah,
I got some mealworms at one time there that they used for chicken feed, and the mealworms, the jays and the magpies really like mealworms.
Yeah.
So they'll come for those. So you've got a lot of different kinds of things you can do, and just put out a bunch of feeders. The location of the feeders is pretty important, because birds like cover.
Right.
So they like to be in bushes or trees and not go far for the feeders. And so you generally don't want to put a feeder right out in the middle of the lawn. But there's a place downtown, a big four-story condo, where these guys have a feeder on their porch that is just exposed to everything, and there's always birds there. Yeah. So,
who knows? Birds have their own minds.
They want lunch.
This went by really fast. Hummingbirds are and backyard bird feeders are a great subject, and I want to do another show on more about the sort of urban birds and all that, but we've run out of time.
Whoa. So,
yeah.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. So thank you, Mr. White Keys, President Grand Poobah of the Anchorage Audubon Society, and for my earlier guest, Kate McLaughlin, who is the hummingbird expert. That was fascinating. And Leslie Swada from Ketchikan. Our producer is Eric Bork. Hannah Doro is our assistant producer who sets up the shows. The show is called Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.